tuned in to the Community Cats Podcast. Ready? Let's go.
Welcome to the Community Cats Podcast. I am your host, Stacey LeBaron. I've been involved helping homeless cats for over 30 years with the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society. The goal of this podcast is to expose you to amazing people who are improving the lives of cats. I hope these interviews will help you learn how you can turn your passion for cats into action. And today, we're speaking with Joyce Glass. Joyce is an attorney who has dedicated the last 13 years of her career to protecting animals from cruelty and neglect. In 2007, Joyce founded her pro bono legal practice to accomplish her singular goal of providing for animal and human welfare. She does this by providing education, advocating for legislation, and forming partnerships with stakeholders to address animal cruelty issues. Joyce's mantra is, addressing animal cruelty makes our communities safer. Joyce began her pro bono work in the New York and Connecticut area. In New York, she has drafted many legislative initiatives to protect the welfare of companion animals, including regulating pet dealers and rescue organizations. Joyce has enjoyed a long-standing collaboration with law enforcement and the district attorney in Suffolk County, New York, to identify, investigate, and prosecute animal cruelty cases. In 2023, Joyce co-founded the Fund for Animal Cruelty Treatment of Suffolk Incorporated. This is a first-of-its-kind organization in which Joyce is partnering with law enforcement and district attorney's office to cover costs of care for animal cruelty victims whose cases are being prosecuted in Suffolk County. In Connecticut, Joyce serves as an attorney appointed under Desmond's Law for civil and criminal animal cruelty cases. Joyce handles both felonies and misdemeanors, including appearing in all pretrial hearings, obtaining affidavits from witnesses, contacting out-of-state prosecutors on prior or current criminal matters, speaking with law enforcement, animal control officers, and veterinarians, viewing all evidence, and recommending resolutions to the court. More recently, Joyce has expanded her practice to the Mooresville, North Carolina area, where she contributed to legislation to prohibit the sale of animals in parking lots. This legislation was enacted in March 2025. Joyce holds a JD from Hofstra Law School, an LLM in animal law from Lewis and Clark Law School, and an MBA in taxation and finance from Hofstra University Zarb School of Business. Joyce, I'd like to welcome you to the show.
Thank you so much, Stacey.
Wow. I feel like I need to ask you finance questions. I need to ask you animal care questions. I feel just so much I'm going to be asking you about today. I can't wait for this conversation. It's strange to be excited to talk to a lawyer, but hey, here we go. So first and foremost, how did you become so passionate about animals?
Well, I've always been an animal lover, but in my adult life, there's two dogs that kind of pushed me to go from being a bankruptcy attorney to doing animal welfare work. First dog was Lucy. We adopted her many years ago. Unbeknownst to us, she had fake medical records, and the New York State Attorney General's office was trying to shut her rescue down. And after she passed away, I contacted the Attorney General's office, and then, you know, we submitted paperwork and kind of worked with some of the families. And then several months after, we adopted a dog named Hope, who we still have. She was in an abuse situation in Miami years ago. That case would not have been prosecuted in Miami. Maybe today it would have been. But it really just opened my eyes to the need for the work to be done in this area of the law, and made the change, and it is my absolute passion.
Well, I think it's fantastic, obviously. The challenges around animal cruelty blow my mind, to be honest. There are so many challenges involved in the whole process of looking at cats and dogs as property, looking at them as an example of abuse, of harm, holding cats and dogs as property in these animal cruelty cases. Tell us a little bit about what are the legal rights, you know, of cats. Are cats property? Are they a human being? Are they like a child? How do we relate and compare cats in the legal system?
I mean, cats, just like other animals under the law, are considered property. But the good news is that more recently, so I would say in the last maybe 5 to 10 years, you're really seeing this awareness that animals are something more. They're sentient beings. We have emotional connections with them. They have the same needs as we do, right? The need to be housed properly and receive, you know, vet care and have nutrition. And at the same time, there's also more recognition of the link between animal cruelty and interpersonal violence, right? We know that animal cruelty is a gateway crime to human violence. We know that it's a crime of escalation. And so when you have those two together and you're in a municipality that is educated and recognizes both of those things, you are going to have investigations and prosecutions of cases regardless of if it's a community cat, someone's pet, someone's dog, cat, horse, or hamster, because there is an understanding that someone who abuses a community cat is just as likely to move on to an escalating crime or to people as someone who abuses a dog.
And is that true, like, in every state? Is that true across the country, or are, like, cats treated differently on a state-by-state basis?
I mean, it depends on the municipality, because you'll find, of course, a lot of differences throughout the United States. You know, at a state level, there's not many states that mention community cats. And if they do, it's not to say that they're addressing them in the animal cruelty sense. So, for instance, like Nevada and New York, they will say that an animal is every living creature. In California, they do have a definition for feral cats. In Virginia, a companion animal is any domestic or feral cat falls into that, right? Notably, Utah just had a law that went into effect in May of this year stating that community cats are exempt from feeding bans and are not exempt from the cruelty statute, right? So you have all of these various mentions of community cats, but they leave it really to the municipalities themselves to pass local ordinances or rules or protocols, which I think is a good idea. Because when you have grassroots efforts at local levels, you're getting together a good collaboration, right? If you're doing things correctly, of the people working on these issues, right? So those could be the community cat caretakers, general advocates, veterinarians, animal control, law enforcement, to come up with solutions that are going to work in that community, particular to that community, right? So you have, like in Wake County, North Carolina, they have had the community cat collaboration since 2012. Where animal control has a point of contact for specific community cats. So if there's a complaint made or one of them winds up at the shelter, you have a person to call, right? And then you figure out what the situation is. You have Fixing Felines in Long Island, who's been doing amazing TNR work. And during the pandemic, they were still out doing work. And I think in 2020 or 2021, they provided spay and neuter to like 2,000 community cats, but they're educating, right? And people now know that they are someone that they can go to as a resource. And that's when you're really making some positive change for the cats themselves and for the community. You know, when you don't have that collaboration, then you're not getting such great results. So like in the state of Connecticut, there's no county level government. So things are passed at the state level. And earlier this year, there was a law that was proposed by a legislator that did not get input from anyone actually doing the work, which included animal control officers. It did have to do with community cats and euthanasia. And unfortunately, when the public comment session came up, the animal control officers voiced their concerns, which were all valid issues. But had they all sat down together beforehand, you could have worked out and come up with some sort of a resolution. And as far as the municipalities go, you know, if it's a municipal issue, then it falls on the municipality to fund what the solutions would be, right? And that's where some of the problems come up. However, sometimes it's just a matter of educating the municipality that if there's funding provided, particularly when it comes to TNR, over time, that cost will reduce because you're controlling the population. And so I think that there just has to be some viable solutions to go along with the issues. There could be sponsorships. We've done that in Suffolk County before where you can sponsor a feral cat and they were matched up. So people understood that there was an actual animal that they were helping. So the collaboration among stakeholders for any animal cruelty case or animal issue is vital, and it's how the change is made.
So there's a fine line, or maybe it's not that fine of a line, between animal cruelty, hoarding, cruelty to owned cats versus community cats. How do you define, I guess, animal cruelty in some of those scenarios?
I mean, it totally depends on the state that you're in, because you have to go by the statute. I do think when it comes to, you know, we do know that hoarding is 100% recidivism, but that doesn't mean that a case can't be prosecuted. And that's not to say that the goal is to put the defendant in jail, but it is a way for the situation to be dealt with. So, for instance, there was a hoarding case that I was the attorney advocate on in 2024, and the woman had 56 animals living in a two-bedroom house, including chickens, roosters, cats, and dogs. Clearly not, you know, something that was sustainable. And she did get a diversionary program, which is very common in the state of Connecticut. But as the advocate, I laid out what the conditions had to be in order for this to be something that I spoke in favor of before the court. So all of the animals were seized. She was allowed to have one dog back who had to be spayed. And that was a good resolution in that case. And so it just depends on the facts of the case. And it depends on what the state's laws provide for. There have been a couple situations where people were stealing food because they couldn't feed their animals. That is an issue that you say, okay, this came to our attention. What do we do about it? And so what I did when that case came up was to compile a list of resources in Connecticut for people to call if you need food for your animals or vet care.
Let's use a little bit of an example here. If I'm a feeder of a group of cats and I know them by name, I've been feeding them for years, and one of them has been injured intentionally by a human being, you know, shot by BBs or by arrows or something that looks like it's a human situation. If I have an idea who that could have been, or if there's proof, or do you report it to the police? Do you report it to animal control? I mean, what's the process that we should know about if we think harm is coming to the animals that are outdoors that we're caring for?
You can start with animal control and tell them that you would like to make a written complaint. Give them whatever information you have as to why you think it might be this particular person. If you don't get the response from animal control, you can certainly go to your local precinct and tell them that you would like to file a complaint as well. And, you know, sometimes it takes a couple of phone calls or emails. If you send emails, it's also a good idea always to include your local elected officials, pointing out that there is an issue. You don't want to accuse anyone if they haven't been charged, but to say that there is an issue that needs to be investigated. And the reason why is because animal cruelty is very serious. You will get someone to pay attention. So there was a situation we had in Suffolk County, exactly that. There were cats that a caretaker was finding injured. And the detectives that investigate animal cruelty, they had trail cams that they looked at to find who it was. So there's always someone that will listen if you want to be the first voice.
Yeah. And with technology these days, we really should embrace it to help support protecting our cats that are out in our backyards and in our community.
I can't tell you how many people have been charged based on someone's Ring camera, like a neighbor's Ring camera, or there was a case of cats that were abandoned in a Walmart parking lot, and the security cameras identified exactly who it was.
It's estimated there are hundreds of thousands of cats living outside in New York City, over 500,000. And the wild thing? They've always been here, right underfoot. We just haven't been paying attention.
It is cats everywhere. I am very heartbroken.
Starts with one cat, and before you know it, is another one and another one, and then one is really sick. I started making phone calls. Can somebody come pick them up?
Rain, snow, shine. How they survive is beyond me.
Think about feeding 29 cats every morning. I couldn't afford to do that.
This isn't just a story about cats. It's about systems, about poverty, housing, burnout, and what happens when we're forced to build something better from the ground up. From Flatbush Cats, this is Underfoot, a new podcast uncovering New York City's cat crisis and how we can fix it together. Follow now wherever you listen.
When we launched the Community Cats podcast, our goal was simple: share stories and strategies to help cat lovers turn their passion into action. But something amazing happened. Our community grew, and so did our mission. Over the years, we've added webinars, conferences, certification courses, downloadable tools, and a whole lot more to support people who care about cats. So it's time for our name to reflect everything we do. The podcast isn't going anywhere, but our overall platform is rebranding as Community Cat Central. It's the same team, the same heart, and the same commitment, just with a fresh new look and even better ways to help you take action for cats in your community. You'll start seeing updates soon, including a brand new website, smarter email tools, and resources that are easier to access and use. We're so grateful to have you on this journey with us, and we can't wait to show you what's next.
Want an easy grant opportunity for your animal organization? Maddie's Fund is giving away a $3,000 grant each month to one lucky Maddie's Pet Forum member. You'll automatically be entered to win each month when you start a new discussion, reply to a new post, or upload a new library resource. Learn more at forum.maddiesfund.org today.
So in the case of animal cruelty and where it goes through courts, it's my understanding that the cats have to be held in a shelter or in a boarding facility during the period of time that the case is being prosecuted, which could go for months. Is that true?
So the general accepted protocol is that they don't necessarily need to be held. So there could be some reasons for them to be held. So if there are animals in general that are highly valuable or someone may be looking specifically to get them back, yes, then they can be held in a shelter. But generally, that is not the best thing for the animal, right? So there's a couple of ways to look at it. If the defendant refuses to surrender the animals, in every state, the civil forfeiture action can be commenced. So that means that the impounding agency can go to court, the civil court, and say, under the criminal statute, this dog or cat or hamster has been neglected or cruelly treated, and we think that the ownership should be vested in us. So those are statutes that I really encourage people to make sure are being enforced in their municipalities, because many times they're not. The town attorney is typically the one that would have to file that. Some of them are, if they've never done it before, they don't know how to go about it. That provides the most protection to cruelty victims in cases. So in the cases that I am appointed as an advocate on, I will always appear in those cases as well. And that's how we get most protection, because then if the impounding agency, which would typically be the municipality, gains ownership, that animal is permitted to move on. Okay. Now, while that case is pending, those animals can certainly go into a foster home. I visited many victims in foster homes, you know, to see how they're doing, to advise the court. You just have to make sure that you have proper protocols in place, that they are properly cared for and housed and all of that. But it is best if they do not remain in the shelter for obvious reasons. But again, that's something that has to, a lot of times stakeholders have to be educated on. There have been a couple of cases that I have worked on where animal control was told that the animals cannot go to foster, which is not the case. And one of the things, too, with the civil forfeiture actions, we will take the results of that civil forfeiture action and bring it to the criminal court. So if the civil court has found that the animal was neglected or cruelly treated, I will take the transcript and the order and bring it to the criminal court, because they're not following each other, to tell them, hey, this is what was found in the case, because the evidence in the civil cases is the same as will be used in the criminal.
So there's one important component that you have brought forward, you know, in addition to sort of the law and being an advocate and enforcing in the law. There's a role with regards to education, collaborating, accountability, getting everybody together, law enforcement, veterinarians, prosecutors. So is this something we do in the moment in time, or is this something we do before anything happens?
Oh, well, ideally, of course, it's done before. Of course. However, it does sometimes take a case to bring everyone together. I can tell you that one of the things that has helped is, so in Connecticut, Desmond's Law was passed in 2016. It is the Courtroom Attorney Advocate Program Law. I knew about the law prior to getting admitted in Connecticut because there was a very similar program that existed in Onondaga County for years before that. And basically, it permits pro bono attorneys to be appointed in cruelty cases, criminal and civil. And we take part, as you mentioned at the beginning, in all parts of the case. But what that allows us to do is kind of bring all the stakeholders together, because all of the various stakeholders, animal control, law enforcement, veterinarians, the prosecutors, the courts, they're very, very busy. And so we kind of fulfill the role of bringing everybody together so that all of the pieces of the case can fit together. And then everybody has the other person's contact information, right? Because the best way to deal with these cases is to be able to pick up the phone and say, I have an animal. They have to be seen at the vet. Who can see them now? Or I need a necropsy done. In Connecticut, we are also very fortunate because one of our stakeholders is Desmond's Army. They are the volunteer organization that advocated for the law to be passed. The law has been in effect for 9 years, and they are still, every single day, they are in court in Connecticut on the cruelty cases, monitoring them, advocating, keeping a database. They provide funding for the necropsies. They provide rewards for animals that have been abandoned or found deceased. And so all of these stakeholders together makes that law work. And then we as the attorneys can go into court, and the law says that we speak in the interest of and act in the interest of justice. And so what that means for us is that we can go into court with all of the information we have to recommend to the court what the consequences should be, such that they act as a deterrent. And that one of the components of that is to paint the picture and tell the story of the pattern of behavior to show that the defendant may not have only acted one time with this victim. It could have been over many months, right? And like in one case, I did that by showing healed injuries, and we knew that they were over a period of time. It could also be to point out the larger pattern of behavior if they've had other animal cruelty charges or charges involving humans. And we've been able to really get some good resolutions in cases with attorney advocates appointed on them. So one of them, and these are all pretty recent, in 2023, there was a case in Connecticut. It's still in the news because he's been arrested several times, but the Ray Neuberger case, he was charged with 2 felony animal cruelty counts against cats. One did not survive. The other one was severely injured. He was involved with a woman who owned the cats, and there was domestic violence involved. The significance in that case was that we had an attorney advocate that went to court for the entire length of the case, and they are lengthy. But to get felony animal cruelty charges and jail time in Connecticut on a cruelty case is rare. So we do celebrate that because, of course, these are cases that now people are made aware of, and it's precedent for other cases. There was a case that just a couple of weeks ago involved a community cat. The case had been on the docket 18 times. It involved the defendant's own dog and a community cat that they had been feeding. The cat was killed, and that defendant was denied the diversionary programs that are very often given out in Connecticut for cruelty cases. But the advocate spoke against it, as did the prosecutor, and they were denied. So now he will have to face charges and have a record. In another case that I was appointed on, there was a cat who was not the victim, and we were able to get some protection for him because the two victims that the defendant was charged with, one passed away and one was severely neglected. And she lied to the court as to whether or not there were other animals in the home, which happened to be a cat. And the court did not grant my argument that the cat should be seized and held for protection. However, I pointed out to the court that we had a duty to provide protection because the way the pattern of behavior, what it showed was that he was going to be next. So she was granted a diversionary program based upon her age and some other factors. But what I was able to successfully have incorporated in there was that for the time that she was on that program, every quarter that cat had to either go to the vet at her cost and then the report be provided to animal control, or she had to produce the cat for a welfare check. So that was something that was really good because he wasn't the victim. She wasn't charged. This was something they had never done. So now at least he has some protection. And we know that going forward, that type of consequence can be used.
Right. And that really helps animal control's ability to be able to do those welfare checks, too.
Absolutely. Yes.
So you talked about Desmond's Law, Desmond's Army, and a database. What are your thoughts about animal cruelty registries, and do they talk? Like, does the Connecticut list talk to other states to see if the same person is in different states?
Unfortunately, no. I actually did a nationwide study on animal abuser registry several years ago to kind of see what was going on. Currently, the only state registry is Tennessee. Otherwise, they're local municipalities. And it depends on who is updating them. I do think that they are a good idea. I can tell you that of the ones that existed when I did the study, no municipality, including the state, the entire state of Tennessee, incurred any cost to manage those. And I bring that up because Connecticut voted one down many years ago. And when I inquired as to why, I was told that the cost would be too much. And I said, well, there's no cost, though. It's literally just another tab on whatever website is going to manage it, right? And then it's just input. So I do think they're a good idea because it is something, right, for someone to be able to do a search for. It is something, some more accountability and protection for animals. Because I can tell you that there are rescues that they will search. And if a defendant has been accused of anything having to do with children, they will not adopt to them because they know that it goes together. So it should be the same thing, right? So yes, I am in favor of abuser registries.
Interesting. I think Desmond's Law sounds fantastic. And then the fact that there's Desmond's Army and it's been going for 9 years. So you have this long-term journey. It sounds really like an incredible model to help support and protect the rights of animals in the state. And when I'm talking about animals, is it cats and dogs? I know you said hamster. What about farm animals?
Desmond's Law, unfortunately, is limited to dogs and cats. It does need to be expanded. There have been cases where judges have used their discretion to appoint advocates in cases other than dogs and cats. So there was a swan case in some cases that involved dogs, cats, and other animals. However, it's really left up to that particular judge. So I think, though, the recognition, like I said before, that somebody who's an animal abuser, they're not limiting themselves to dogs and cats, and then, you know, they're the only ones that are then moving on to people or escalating the crime. It's anybody who abuses an animal. So that is something that does need to be amended in the law. It's being worked on. And there is definitely evidence for it. The Desmond's Army database is being analyzed now. It's almost done to show how many other types of animals were victims in these cruelty cases where attorney advocates were not given the opportunity to be appointed in those cases.
Joyce, if folks are interested in finding out more about the work that you are doing, how would they do that?
I am on LinkedIn, so I do post information on there so people can contact me through that. That's probably the best way.
And is there anything you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Just, you know, one person can definitely make a difference. Don't be afraid to be a voice because you will find someone to help you. Sometimes the biggest cases start with just one person calling in about a barking dog or a dog maybe left outside. There are plenty of examples of that. So I would just say to people, don't be afraid to be the first one to speak for an animal.
Joyce, this has been an incredibly fascinating conversation, and I want to thank you so much for agreeing to be a guest on the show, and I hope we'll have you on again in the future.
Thank you, Stacey.
That's it for this week. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review. We love to hear what you think, and a 5-star review really helps others find the show. You can also join the conversation with listeners, cat caretakers, and me on Facebook and Instagram. And don't forget to hit follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single show. Thanks for listening, and thank you for everything that you do to help create a safe and healthy world for cats.